Okay, so something really strange is happening. In the weeks before dying, patients will often start seeing loved ones who have already died. They'll say someone is in the room. They'll say they're being visited. And again, they'll say some version of the same thing. I'm going home. And by the way, this isn't just anecdotal. Hospice Buffalo found that 88.1% of dying patients reported a deathbed vision. And that lines up with research from nearly 50 years earlier, when a large study looked at tens of thousands of counts from people near death. But here's the part I can't get past. The medical community is adamant that this is not the same thing as delirium or hallucination. It must be something else. Like a boundary between two worlds is thinning. Hospice nurse Julie McFadden has witnessed this firsthand. And last year we had Julie on the podcast and more than 500,000 people watched that conversation. But this time we wanted to go deeper. Why do so many dying patients say they're going home? And what does that reveal about where our home actually is? We're about to find out. But real quick, there are a lot of new people here. We're about to cross a major milestone with this channel, and honestly, it's been really beautiful to see. But one of the things our team has been noticing is that a lot of you watch these episodes, come back to them, even send them to people you love, and still haven't subscribed. So I'm just asking you plainly, if this show has helped you or you want more conversations like this, hit the subscribe button. And if you already have, hit the notification bell so you don't miss what's next. A lot goes into the show behind the scenes, the research, the guests, the questions, the care. And we do that because we really, really want to help you. So please help us keep doing that. Subscribe if you haven't already. It genuinely makes a difference. Julie, there's a story in your book that I haven't been able to stop thinking about, a woman named Juanita. What struck me really is like what she was saying and her demeanor while she was saying it. So take me into her backstory a little bit.
Yes. Juanita was a huge surprise to me as well. I can remember when we did her admission, meaning we put her on hospice. It was her and her caregiver there, and I think she was like in her 80s or something. And I remember almost not being able to get her on service, meaning like she wanted to be admitted for her disease, but she was not far along enough that she almost wasn't appropriate to be on hospice. Okay. So we did the whole admission. I was going to see her the next week. And I remember her caregiver called me like 3 days later and said she had died. I remember thinking like, What do you mean she died? Like, because she was walking and talking and eating and totally oriented. There was no decline. So I go to declare her dead because I'm the hospice nurse. And when I got there, her caregiver said, "You're not going to believe this, but last night we were making blueberry muffins as we always do on whatever day it was. When we were done, she got ready for bed, went to bed, and basically with a smile on her face, said, you know, please come here to our caregiver. And she was saying all these things like, thank you so much for taking care of me. Please promise me you'll take care of my son, because she had a disabled son. Please promise me you'll continue to take care of him when I'm gone." Mm-hmm. And she's like, and this, the caregiver's like, "What are you talking about? I'm going to see you tomorrow." And she goes, no, I'm going home. I'm tired. I'm going home." And then, of course, the caregiver, "You are home. You know, what do you mean you're going home?" She just said, "I'm tired. I'm going home. Can you bring my son in?" Brings her son in, does a bunch of sweet nothings again. "You know, I love you. I'll always love you. Thank you for being the best son." And he just like gleefully, like, "I love you too, Mom." Like, you know, "I love you too, Mom." And then goes about his night, right? And the caregiver did think it was weird, but didn't think anything of it really. And then the next morning when she walked in to help her get up and start her day, she was gone. Hmm. And then she called me. And I do see people choosing when they're going to die. I have seen this before, but nothing like this. Nothing so overt. Nothing so dramatic where it was like she was fine one day, laid in bed one night and said, "I'm going to die. I'm going home." And then did. Hmm. And then did.
What's really interesting about that story is, like, you know, a lot of people's mindsets are shaped by, I don't know, beliefs or religious systems, or, but like like you said, it seemed like she was like choosing when to die. And then there was like a demeanor or certainty. And then, you know, the I'm going home thing. Like when people are at end of death and they have such a peace and a certainty and a conviction, like what does that mean to you? Like when you see someone with that type of peace and certainty?
Yeah, I mean, this is why I always say my job isn't depressing, because not everyone's like that. But most of the time, even if someone's not saying something like, I'm ready to go, or I'm going home, or I'm okay, they still usually have a demeanor of peace. It's like they eventually always get to a place of acceptance, most of the time. Every once in a while, not so much, which I also can talk about. And because I've seen it so often, it brings me comfort. There is something that happens at the end of life to me that seems to allow people to let go, to surrender, to be okay with, and to have some acceptance. And there's certainly some people who are not only ready to go, but like excited to go.
Is when someone is speaking in such a way that she was, like, is that one of the questions that came up for me? Is that like a lucid thing? Like, is it like I'm talking to you right now? And I know, okay, Julie's not losing her mind, and she's speaking to me right now. Or is it kind of like they're just off their wagon or something like that?
Well, in her case, she was lucid, because I wasn't there, but her caregiver said she was totally lucid, and it was like she was planning to go somewhere. And of course, she couldn't tell until afterwards, because she actually did die. You know, she didn't actually think she was going to die, even though she was lucidly saying, like, I'm dying, I'm going home tonight.
Yeah.
But the caregiver said she was calm, she was herself, and she just knew. So I would say it's half and half, because I've definitely seen people talk about, like, going on a train ride, getting ready for a trip, getting ready to go home, but they aren't necessarily lucid.
Okay.
But then they do die, so there must be something that they know.
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously not the first time we spoke.
Yeah.
You know, I was really struck. I mean, I was calculating, I think it was almost exactly a year to maybe the day. I don't know. Maybe like a plus one day, but right. It was literally 2025, like a year ago.
Yeah.
We sat here. And like more than 500,000 people watched that conversation. I think there were so many comments, and, you know, I think it hit people so deeply because of the stories. And the question underneath almost every other question is like, do we simply disappear when we die, or do we go somewhere else? You know, we ended the last episode and you talked about this feeling of home and being homesick, in another world. And since that conversation, I think for me personally, you were like the pathway into like looking into a lot of like the deathbed vision stuff. And I've just was really struck by like how much research has been done around this stuff,
yeah,
and documentation about what happens at the deathbed. So, I mean, let's just assume someone didn't see that first conversation. How common are those types of experiences?
So in my book, Nothing to Fear, chapter 6 is where I talk about deathbed phenomena. And it's my longest chapter because there's so much to say and so much to talk about. Deathbed visions are incredibly common. I mean, so common that we put them in our literature to educate people. So to educate other clinicians, to educate family and patients, so they don't feel like they're quote unquote going crazy when they're getting close to the end of life. We tell other clinicians so they know what to look out for, because if someone's visioning, that usually means they have about 3 weeks to live. So there's a way that we can kind of gauge where they are in the dying process by what's going on with them, right? So visioning usually happens a few weeks before death. You know, 1/3 of all patients, meaning 1 in 3 people, will have terminal lucidity, which is when you have like the rally or the surge, that burst of energy that happens right before you die. I mean, 1 of 3 people will have that. Mm-hmm. And it's really important to educate families about that so they can enjoy the rally, so they know what it is and they can actually be there for this person when they're getting this burst of energy, to be lucid, to have energy, to talk, to laugh, their old personality comes back. And then to also know that usually means they're going to die shortly after, right? So you don't want to miss it.
That's so fascinating, like on a clock, 3 weeks.
I know.
Before death.
It's wild.
Yeah.
And what's even more wild about that is a lot of people, you know, think it's right on the deathbed, right? It's right before they die. So they must be delirious or they have low oxygen or they're so heavily medicated. No. I mean, it can happen then, but most of the time, it's like me and you sitting here.
Yeah.
They're barely medicated, if at all. They don't have low oxygen. They're alert and oriented. And they're almost as surprised as anyone else that they're seeing things.
Yeah. When I looked into, after our conversation, I looked into a study that was done by Hospice Buffalo.
Yeah.
And they found that as people approach death, the frequency of the visions increases.
Yeah.
Which I thought was remarkable.
And I think now that I'm not afraid to ask people as a hospice nurse, not to like get stories, right? But just so I know what's going on. Like I might not say, are you having visions? But I'll educate about the end of life and what to expect.
Yeah.
And then I'll say, you know, people sometimes do see dead relatives, old friends who have died, pets who have died. And because I bring that up almost every visit, people go, oh, that's already been happening. Or, oh, that happened with my uncle. You know, so I think because I bring it up, I can see now really how often it happens because people aren't afraid to say something once they know you're already educating on it. A lot of times before, I think I didn't know because I was never saying anything. And I think people keep it to themselves because they're afraid.
So when people use the term deathbed visions or phenomena, what exactly does that include?
To me, there probably is an actual definition, but to me, I look at it as them seeing either dead relatives, people who have died. They don't have to be relatives because sometimes relatives are not someone you want to see, right? A lot of people say like, oh, I don't want to see my grandparents. But it's usually comforting people. So people who have died that are comforting to you, whether that's family, friends, people definitely see pets. People will see lights. People will hear music. That's a big one. People will go, do you hear that music? And I'm like, I wish. No, I don't.
One of the comments we got, I mean, so it's actually in the hospice textbooks. And people are like, well, what does that mean? That it's actually in the hospice textbooks, like onboarding materials. So explain to me that.
Yeah. So most hospices, when you get admitted to hospice, they will have a pamphlet of information that no one ever looks at. But I always try to encourage to look at it because there's really good, useful information in there.
Yeah.
And there's usually a little blue book written by Barbara Carnes, the queen of hospice. I love her. And it's a 13-page pamphlet. And it basically just gives you like signs and symptoms of death and dying. And it goes like month by month, week by week. And then once you get to days, what someone will look like. And in that blue book, and many others, but this is where I see it most often, is where it says, you know, around the month mark, people will start seeing the unseen, she said. And that means, you know, people who have died, usually family, friends, pets.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember seeing that as an ICU nurse when I first started. And I was like, what are we doing here? What are we doing? Like, what does this book even mean? Because I just felt like, how can we say something like that? We're medical professionals. Like, what do you mean they start seeing the unseen?
Yeah.
Until I saw for my own eyes, it's like,
yeah.
Now here I am on a podcast talking about it.
Yeah. So I think a fascinating premise today is not only what happens when we die. It's like, you know, if all of this is real, what are we supposed to do with the life that we have now? And so before we get to what this means, I do want to slow down and help people understand what is happening. Because I think for a lot of people, the first instinct will be skepticism. And honestly, I think that's like very, very fair. Is your skepticism, like you just said. You know, so if someone says to me, like, my dead parents came to me last night, most of us are going to wonder, like, is this delirium? Is it medication, oxygen deprivation, hallucination, or maybe even like the brain comforting itself? And so, like, what would your response be to that?
My response would be, we don't know exactly why it happens, but we do know things that it's not, right? It is not oxygen deprivation. We know this because the person has perfectly fine oxygen. We check it every time we're there. They're not on oxygen. Even if they were, their oxygen levels are fine. It's not delirium. Delirium is very specific. And if you're a healthcare professional who works in this industry, we know what delirium looks like. One, there's usually severe agitation with delirium, and they're saying all types of weird stuff, right? They're not clear about what's going on. Those are the two I hear the most. Oh, medication. So too much medication. We also know what that looks like. Envisioning is not like any of those things. And when I was a new hospice nurse, I was skeptical too. The thing with visioning is that most people that are doing it are very clear. And they're either not on medications, they don't have a history of delirium, their disease shouldn't be causing delirium, and their oxygen levels are definitely fine because they're weeks out from death, right? So most of the visioning that I see are with very lucid, alert, and oriented people, and they are calm, and they're almost like a messenger. That's what it feels like. When I hear someone tell me about what they are witnessing in real time sometimes, or like last night this happened to me, they say it with such a calmness most of the time. It almost feels like a messenger, like they're telling us something really special. Every once in a while, I get someone who's not afraid of what they saw, but they're afraid of sounding quote unquote crazy, right? So they'll kind of like whisper to me because they're afraid they're going to get like taken away or heavily medicated because everyone's going to think they're, again, crazy. But most of the time, it's like, I've witnessed this thing and now I have to tell you about it.
Yeah.
And I feel so much comfort.
Is there a difference between hallucination and delirium?
Yeah. So I would say delirium is very specific. There's agitation involved. You can't really talk sense into the person who's delirious. So they're usually trying to get out of bed a lot and it's unsafe. So there's this like agitation and restlessness along with delirium. There's usually, maybe they're speaking, but they're not making sense. Hallucinations too. I suppose we could call visioning hallucinations, but it has to be comforting. Most of the time, there's certain disease like Alzheimer's, dementia, Parkinson's. Those patients, especially with Parkinson's, there's actually part of the disease will cause you to hallucinate, to see things. And usually those things are scary. Usually it's like a big spider crawling on the ceiling. Usually there's a black shadow. Mm-hmm. And they scare the person. Anything scary to me is not visioning. Visioning, whenever I've seen it, which is often, is, again, calming. It calms the person. They're very clear on what they're seeing. Whereas with people like with dementia or Parkinson's, when I've seen them say that they're seeing things, they're yelling, they're scared, they want to be protected from the thing.
Yeah.
So it's different. It's a different feeling.
Yeah. I mean, that does create even distinction kind of between a hallucination even, or the way that we would typically understand it versus this. I mean, one thing I'm really curious about that I want to drill down into further is like this person's state of mind. So like, do they know who they are, where they are, who you are when they're saying this stuff? And is it just like, I don't know, just like this conversation.
Most of the time they know who they are, where they are. Most of the time they're alert and oriented, like by to person, place, thing, and time. But sometimes it is someone who does have dementia. They're not very clear. But then suddenly they'll be clear and go like, my mom's here, right? And then you say, you know, you're looking around your mom, and then the wife will be like, his mom died forever ago, but he's been saying that a lot. So sometimes they're still clear, but they're not cognitively totally with it, right? But they still say things, or they have full conversations with someone who's not there. That is usually really clear, not agitated.
Full conversation with someone who's not in the room.
Correct. Like they'll be talking to Bob, and then I'll be like looking at the wife, like, who is Bob? And she'll be like, that's his brother. He's been talking to his brother like all day today. So to me, even that looks different than someone with Alzheimer's who's just confused, because they're usually really happy. They're usually really having normal conversations, but we just can't see the person that's there.
Yeah.
But a lot of times I would say people are alert and oriented. And they're talking like me and you, and they're saying that they have seen their loved one, you know, last night at the bedside. My loved one said they're coming to get me, and not to be afraid, you know.
How often is the person deceased?
I mean, I would say all the time they're deceased. Yeah, there's been times when people with Alzheimer's and stuff will be saying they're talking to a person who's not deceased, yeah. But a lot of times they're agitated. I mean, it's an unknown thing, and this is just my personal opinion, right? Like, if yeah. they're not with this particular instance of, like, if they're dead or not, because there, yeah, because there's some people who will see people who are not dead. You know, they'll see their cousin, but their cousin lives in Georgia, but they're not dead.
Yes.
I don't know if that's visioning. I don't know what that means, right? Yeah. But when I guess I would consider visioning when they're dead. Like, they're getting messages from people beyond.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I found that to be fascinating. It did seem like, from a large-scale literature perspective, it seemed like when people do see living people, like, sometimes it behaves more like a particular type of hallucination of, like, they might be agitated or something like that. But it seems like the dead relative thing is more peaceful, and it seems like to be a distinction. I don't know if you've seen that in your clinical work.
Say it one more time.
Just a like, so for example, like, yeah. If people are trying to figure out, like, is this just like this, like, bizarre thing that's happening? But, like, it is, I'm saying it is interesting that, like, most of the time they're seeing dead people.
Yes.
And so I'm saying that it seemed like from the literature, it seems like sometimes when people see living people, it behaves more like a hallucination.
Correct.
Is that what you see or
that's
no?
What I would say. Yes. Okay. I would say when visioning is like in a category of its own is what I think. Everything else that may happen, like them seeing people who are not dead yet, them having disturbing visions or some things that are scaring them or shadow people. You hear a lot of people talk about seeing shadow people. I do not think, and people might think differently, but I don't think that is in the vision, that is in the vision category. I think that's in like the disease category. Because to me, visioning is just such a different feeling around it and a different, there's just a different way about visioning.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a story in your book about Julio that I feel like captures the emotional complexity of this, and then even the self-consciousness of what they might feel when they're seeing these things. So can you take me into that story?
Yeah. Yeah. That was such a sweet family. So I remember getting a call from the family first and saying, like, you have to come over. My dad's hallucinating. Something's really wrong with him. So I was like, great, I'll be right over. So I went over, and when I walked into the room, the patient was fully alert and oriented. Nothing was going on. He was fine. And, you know, I asked him, like, orienting questions. How's he feeling? What's the date? Who's the president? Yada, yada. And he passed with flying colors. And the kids left the room. And I was about to leave the room to go talk to the kids. And he grabbed my arm and was like, hey, I just saw my parents last night, but they think I'm crazy. But I'm not crazy. They said they're coming to get me, but not right now. And I don't need to worry. And I just said, that's great. How do you feel about that? And he was like, I'm okay. Like, he felt comforted by it, but he knew why I was there, which was his family thinks he's crazy. And he was trying to tell me, like, I know what I saw and it's okay, right? So I just said, it's really normal. Don't worry about it. Like, as long as you're okay with it, like, go with it. And he was like, I'm okay with it. Like, great. I go out to the kids. They pull me aside. I'm telling you, something's wrong with him. He was saying he was seeing his dead parents last night. We need to medicate, or I don't know. There's Haldol in the comfort kit, which is for agitation. And I just said, no, 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 no. This is totally normal. It's called visioning. It happens. And then I usually tell them it happens a few weeks before death so they can kind of prepare themselves. I go, everyone's different, but it's usually, you know, a few weeks before people start dying, they start seeing dead relatives. So as long as he's comforted by it, and as long as he's not like agitated and having a hard time, then we don't worry about it. We don't know what it is, but it seems to bring him comfort.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting because, yeah, the self-consciousness part of it is interesting because, like, if someone was just straight up hallucinating, like, I don't know if they'd be, like, in that mindset of, like, thinking about, like, oh, my God, I don't want to tell my son that I'm seeing my dead mother.
Oh, that's a really good point, yeah. Right?
So yeah. It's so fascinating. Some people will also take the route of, like, maybe this is not a hallucination, but they just kind of see what they want to see. How often do, like, kind of maybe atheists or people who don't really believe in anything spiritual have these sorts of experiences?
Everyone does. It does not matter if you have a belief.
Matter.
No, it does not matter. Not everyone will vision, but you definitely don't have to be religious to have visions. I've had plenty of people who didn't believe in anything have visions. And even then, they still don't say, like, and now I believe. They just go, like, whoa, this is crazy. You know.
So when you say not everyone visions, like, most of them do? Or, like, what would you put a number on that? Like,
I think someone told me once, which I don't know if there actually is a real percentage of this, but about 80% of people will experience visioning.
Okay.
Or at least, like... But I know that's, like, it's probably not totally accurate because not everyone even reports it.
Yeah. But. And I mean, another thing I wanted to really drill in is, like, the pattern around it, because there's so much interesting things here, because it seems like they're not just seeing random things. Like, you said the thing about being a messenger, which I think is really interesting. So when deceased loved ones appear, what do dying people actually say happened?
They usually say they're, like, greeted by their loved one, told not to be, in so many words, like, not to be afraid.
Yeah.
And that they're watching over them or they're coming back for them, you know, not yet, but soon. And it's always about, like, love, do not be afraid, we've got you. And if it's an animal, same thing. I haven't heard anyone say their animal talk to them, but just it just brings them comfort, right?
Yeah.
Then there's definitely been people who said they've seen Jesus, they've seen angels, and when they say that, I don't necessarily think they've said, at least from my experience, there's plenty of experiences out there, but they didn't get verbal messages, but just like a sense of calm and peace.
Okay.
Yeah.
The story of Ginny's last request and the door was also one that was in your book.
Oh my gosh, I know. It was so good. Yeah, so that one was with a patient who I barely knew, but I was visiting a couple times. And I love my job because you get to meet, like, so many amazing people. And this woman was old. Like, I can't remember how old, but, like, definitely in 90s, maybe in her hundreds. I can't remember, but she was old. And her daughter was telling me how she kept asking someone... Her daughter thought she was asking her to open the door. Open the door. Open the door. Kind of getting agitated. Would you open the door? And she kept trying to open different doors, being like, Mom, what are you talking about? The bathroom door, the closet door, the bedroom door? What door? And she was never really satisfied. And then Ginny, the woman dying, started yelling for her brothers and sisters, like, one by one, each by name, saying, like, Randy, go open the door. So-and-so, go open the door. So-and-so, go open the door. And, like, went through her siblings' names. And she had 9 siblings. She was 1 of 10. And her daughter was telling me the story. And I was like, where are her siblings? Like, where are they? And she was like, they're dead. She's the last of 10. She's the last person alive. And over again, she stopped asking me to open the door. And she kept asking her dead siblings to open the door. And then when she eventually died, I remember her, us just talking and, you know, giving our condolences. And her daughter was like, I'm pretty sure her siblings opened that door. I'm like, yeah, that's great. I love it. I love it.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the... if you're actually taking this, like, seriously as, like, something that actually, you know, might be happening, you know, it almost feels like they're, like, caught in between worlds or something like that. Like, when we have our natural just awareness, like, I'm talking to you right now, it's like something is happening as people die, and it seems like they're, like, 1 foot somewhere else and 1 foot here, and, like, they're... Have you ever had someone talk about that state of, like, I'm seeing this, but I'm seeing you too, and, like... I could be talking to you about the groceries that we need to buy later, but I'm also talking about the fact that I just had a conversation with my dead relative.
And yes.
So, yeah.
Yes.
How do they describe this state?
They would describe it as, like, time is slower to an extent where they can, like, see people in the room that are real people who are still alive, right, and doing things, you know, drinking from a soda can, talking to each other. And it's like they say that they feel like they can see and be there with them, but also it's like a slower time. Like there's something where it just feels slow, and this little area where people who are still alive are doesn't feel as important as like what this side feels like, which is where I feel like they're closer to death. And they might not even be seeing anybody, right? But they look at it as like that. Like the real world feels less real, and it feels more slow, and they're not like fully part of it. Mm-hmm. But they're still there. That's how, and not everyone can cognitively explain this to you, yeah. But I have had people try to explain it. And that's the way they try to explain it, that it feels, the real world doesn't feel as real, but this doesn't feel that real either. And everything slows down. They feel part of, but not totally.
Yeah. I'd imagine for them trying to explain it is like so much maybe goes even beyond words of like,
right.
If you're not experiencing that or you're not seeing that, then like, how could you explain that to someone?
Right. They're trying to explain something that it's hard to explain.
Yeah. If your only reference is just like the physical world in front of me and seeing all these things.
They do say though, that it's not scary when that's happening.
Yeah.
It's just more of like an observation.
Yeah. What about the idea of being shown something? Like, cause one of the stories you were talking about earlier, you were saying that the person was saying that we're coming and there's nothing to be afraid of.
Mm-hmm.
Is being shown something by a relative also a theme, or is there additional things that happen there?
I feel like I've heard from other people just through doing this work, like people will write into me and say things that their loved ones said, you know, and I've definitely seen people hear music, which is a little different than being shown something. Yeah. But I've witnessed people like smiling and saying, "Do you hear that? Like, do you hear that music?" Right? And people have written into me too about people saying they've heard music. But I've also had people say to me that their loved one saw things. Like, do you see how beautiful it is? Do you see that? It's like, and they'll describe like a grassy meadow. There's deer over here. There's running water. And I think everyone's vision would be different, right? But there have been people who've written in me saying that their loved one describes things they're seeing, you know, with a smile on their face. I see a lot of that stuff with the death stare more than visioning. So someone will stare off into the distance, usually into the corner of the room or somewhere else to the ceiling, and you can like snap your fingers in front of their face and they won't blink. They're like not really there.
Yeah.
And then when they're like that, they will then smile and say like, and maybe greet someone like, "Oh my gosh," like act like they haven't, you know, they're seeing someone that they haven't seen for years. "I'm so excited to see you. I can't believe I'm seeing you." Or like, "Do you see that? Do you see how beautiful it is?" Reaching up. And that's a little bit different than visioning. They kind of can all go together. But to me, like, that's the death stare where I hear a lot of people say they just, you know, "Do you see that?" And
yeah.
They're like, "What?" And then they'll say the light.
One of the things I loved after our first episode was that, I mean, the amount of comments of people, not just from fellow hospice nurses, but, like, we're talking about this as it relates to hospice care. But a lot of people were saying that even in their own homes, like people were experiencing these things. And I actually had a friend at the end of last year whose grandfather was dying. I don't think he was in hospice care. He might have been. But anyway, she started telling me that he started seeing things. And so it's just so widespread, the phenomena, that like just so many comments of people writing in, like, "My mom experienced this, my grandpa experienced this." It's just like nuts.
That's what I mean. I know. And I do feel like, I'm sure it happens in other settings, but as an ICU nurse, we rarely had the time to like talk to people to have them, you know, I never witnessed any kind of phenomenon like that when I was an ICU nurse. But I feel like because someone on hospice is dying, what we would consider a natural death, it's like usually this gradual type of death. So I don't know if there's something, if it's something to do with that, right? Where the body really is like slowly able to let go. So then it can experience these other things versus like if it happens quickly or in a hospital setting. I mean, I don't know, but.
Yeah. And then the pet piece is like, I find that to be really incredibly moving. Like when people see dying people see pets,
yeah,
what do they usually describe?
They're just usually happy to see their pet.
What are they? They're sitting in the bed?
Yes, they're sitting in the bed. They'll have them come up on the bed. They'll be surprised that no one else can see them, but also surprised that they can see them. They'll dream of them. I mean, pets, and then if pets are not dead, right, and people just have pets and they're dying, their pets will guard them, protect them, take on their symptoms, howl when they die.
But really?
Yes. It's wild.
Wait, the pet is like aware?
Yes. 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 Pets are incredible. Pets are people. I've seen one man's dog. This man that had horrific like nausea and vomiting, couldn't really eat, was really sick, didn't get out of bed. And the dog started taking on the owner's symptoms. He wouldn't eat, would throw up, didn't like walking, would refuse to go on walks. People's pets always protect them. So they're either under the bed or on the bed. Some woman told me that her dog started howling when their loved one died. Pets get it.
That's know. So weird.
And pets go through the actively dying phase. This is kind of a little off topic, but like pets will go through the same things that we go through when dying.
Yeah.
So they often will have actively dying phases. They'll often have the rally where they have this burst of energy. They'll often try to die alone like some humans do. So it's wild.
I found a report online, a story of a 67-year-old woman who reported seeing her husband, who had died 4 years earlier, alongside her dog, who had also passed. Yeah.
Her hubby and her dog. I have a really great video up on one of my channels where a follower of mine sent in her mom, who she heard her mom like loudly talking to multiple people in the room, so much so that it actually like scared her, like something like people came over and she didn't know. So she went to go into the room and then she saw no one was there. So then she just pressed record and you can hear and see her mom joyfully laughing and talking to a room full of people who you do not see, but she clearly does. And she's going, here at last, I finally get to see every one of you. I can like memorize it because it's so cute. Every one of you, this little old lady in bed talking to like a crowd full of people.
That's wild.
I know.
And the
I
fact
know.
That she got that recorded.
I know. Yeah. I know.
Yeah. So, you know, up until this point, I mean, we're talking about what your patients experience, but then, you know, somewhere along the journey for you as a hospice nurse, something started happening. You started to see something.
Yeah. Yeah. That was, So, I mean, okay. So first it starts with a woman who I was doing an admission. I was putting her on hospice and she was young. She was probably in her 50s and her kids were in their early 20s. So I remember being, I mean, I'm always sad for people coming on hospice, but I felt extra sad because she seemed young, her kids were young, and when I saw her, she was actively dying. So she was coming right from the hospital. And she was on death's door. When I say actively dying, she was like cyanotic, which means blue. She was doing the end of life breathing. So she was definitely not like oxygenating her brain. Like she was very close to death. And we got her inside. We got her comfortable. Luckily, she was very comfortable, but she was not totally with it at all. I mean, she was like, I thought I was going to stay there until she took her last breath because I'm like, oh, it's going to happen any minute. And her kids didn't really understand what was going on. So I was trying to educate them that like she was dying and she was dying probably tonight. So once I talked to them and I got her comfortable, I thought I'm just going to hang out here until she dies because it's going to be very soon. And I don't want to have to make them come back, you know, have someone else come back and whatever, and have the kids be alone and all the things. And a few hours went by and she like didn't die, which was okay. But I was like, well, I mean, I got to go. So I told the kids like, hey, listen, I do have to go, but you know, whenever your mom does die, please call us. We'll come back. We'll help you organize everything. Uh-huh. She looks really comfortable in there. Don't worry, blah, blah, blah. And I went to her room, which I never do this, but for some reason, That day, I remember putting my hands on her bed and closing my eyes and basically like saying a little prayer to her, like, I wish you the best, something like that. And I got this little flash of something, which I'll get to in a second, in my head. But I brushed it off because I am a skeptical nurse, wasn't thinking anything of it, and I left. And then the next day, I looked through my emails to see who went to go do the death visit, and like what time she died and things like that. And there was no email. So I called the office and I'm like, what happened to so-and-so? Like, who went to go do the death visit? Oh, no, no one called. She must not have died. I don't know. And I'm like, no, that's impossible. There's like literally no way she could have made it through the night. And they're like, I don't know, maybe she went to the hospital, whatever. So I called the family and the son answered and he sounded happy. And I thought that was like strange. And I was like, hey, how'd the night go? What happened? And he goes, oh, mom slept through the night, which to me, it's like was not sleeping. She was unconscious and blue, you know, she was like very close to death. But he goes, she slept through the night and woke up this morning and said she was hungry and wanted pancakes. And I remember being like, what? And he's like, yeah. And then I could hear her and her daughter laughing in the background. And he's like, yeah, she's at the kitchen table. She wanted pancakes. And I was like, do you care? Okay. I'm like, great. Do you mind if I come over? Because I wanted to see this for myself. And he's like, sure. So I went over there and of course, like the nurse in me was like bearer of bad news. She has having the biggest rally I've ever seen and she's going to die shortly after. That's exactly what I thought. I thought this is just some extreme rally.
Yeah.
So I see her, she's laughing, she's talking, she's walking. And for anyone who's in the medical profession, they would know this is literally impossible. This woman was not getting oxygen to her brain. There was no way her brain could have come back from where she was at to be fully alert and oriented and eating and totally normal. So I was like, wow, I feel like I've witnessed a miracle, but the biggest rally ever. And then she didn't die. She didn't die. She lived another 3 months, which I know is still not that long, but that's a very long time for hospice. She lived another 3 months, totally walking, talking, not having pain, enjoying herself. And the thing that I never talked about, which is what we're getting to, is because I was very embarrassed and I didn't want anyone to think I was, again, quote unquote, crazy, is that that night before I left, I put my hands on her bed, like I said, which again is not normal for me. And what flashed in my mind was a vision of this huge being that was behind her bed. And it was definitely like, it felt like it had wings, but they were tucked behind. It was all cream. There was no facial features, and it was huge. And
they had no facial features?
No, not that I saw. Didn't feel weird though. Just felt like it was like as big as a car. If a car was like standing on two wheels, it was like huge. And what struck me was, because this happened in like a millisecond, what struck me was it wasn't warm and fuzzy at all. It was not scary, but it was not warm and fuzzy. It felt like this powerful force. And the message basically was, she's mine. I've got this. Or like that. But not exact, but around like, she's mine. I've got this. Hmm. And it was almost like making itself known to me, but not at all being like, trying to discuss. But it felt like it just wanted to make itself known to me that I've got this, don't worry about it. And I remember, like, I knew that had happened, but I'm such a skeptic and this doesn't normally happen to me that I was like, whatever, like, just put that on my mind. And because I just tell myself that I'm making this all up in my head. But then when I came back the next day and she was alert and oriented and it was a true miracle, she didn't die the next day like I thought. She didn't die after a rally. She lived for another 3 months, almost symptom-free. And yes, she did die 3 months later, but she had 3 good months where she was almost symptom-free with her family. And I feel like I saw her angel, not even a angel. I think it was hers.
Wow. I mean, to come back from the brink of death at that level and then have that sort of rebound. I mean, you talked about the rally a little bit, but the rally has been like 2 days and
right. This
is like 3 months.
Yeah. And that's not the rally, by the way. For anyone who's listening, the rally only lasts like 2 days. Yeah. If it lasts longer than that, it's not the rally.
So, I mean, the next day, like when you realized that she was like still alive, did you then start to interpret this as more of like an angel figure, or over the course of time you started to like think about it more, the experience?
No, it was the next day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause I knew what I saw. And this happens often to me where like something like that will happen and I try to brush it away and then I'll be like, never mind. Cause right when I saw her, I was like, oh, wow, that was real. What I saw in my mind. Now I didn't tell anybody. Probably for 7 years.
You didn't say anything about it for
No,
seven
I mean,
years?
I told maybe my best friend who would like believe me, but like, no, I didn't. I definitely didn't tell them.
Yeah.
Which I do regret. I regret maybe not saying like, I saw your angel, but I do regret not asking her questions about like, what, did you feel anything? Did you see anything? Like, I did tell the family that she was a miracle. You know, it's a miracle. I witnessed a miracle is what I believe. And they believed it too, but we never had a conversation about what she experienced. You know, I never said anything about what I saw. I never told anybody at work about what I saw.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because like, you know, the skeptical perception of these sorts of things is that people just blast these things on the internet and, but the fact that you just like didn't say anything about this for 7 years.
Yeah,
no. And I mean, I think a lot of people, if they experience these sorts of things, you know, there's a huge percentage of the population probably like don't say anything.
Yeah.
Because, oh, they're going to think I'm a nut job. Like, they think this is crazy. But
I'm going to lose credibility. That's what I always think.
Yeah.
Even when I first started TikTok and I told the story, I always just called it the miracle story.
Yeah.
I left out the whole like part of the angel thing because the story itself without the angel thing
is remarkable.
Is remarkable. Yeah. So I used to always just tell it without that part.
Yeah.
And then eventually I got brave enough.
Now, I can't imagine like witnessing everything that we've talked about so far, not once, but twice over and over again, having this experience, yeah. The shared death experience that you talked about before, and keeping it in like some clean professional category for you. I mean, maybe some people can do that, but like at some point I'd imagine it starts to shape how you see reality. And so how has all of this shaped your own spiritual life?
I think like we talked about in our last conversation about like, you know, ever since I've been a little girl, I've always questioned like the state of the universe and why we were here. I would always ask really big questions, even for like a 5-year-old.
Yeah.
And I think because of that, I've had like many experiences and my own beliefs about like why we're here, what happens after we die. And then becoming a hospice nurse has just sort of helped solidify that. Like watching people, not even seeing the visioning. The visioning's cool, right? But really being witness to people taking their last breath is what has helped solidify what I believe, which is like we're all going back to a place we've already been. And I feel like when I'm watching someone take their last breath, it's almost like I'm there again. Like I can almost be there with them. It's almost like it comes into the room with us. And there's a knowing, there's just a knowing of like presence, of that we're all one, that we're all connected, that we're all going back to the same place that we've come from. And that, again, these are my beliefs, so they're not everyone's beliefs, but that's what hospice has helped me be like, oh, okay, yeah, this is like solidifying everything I've always thought and known. Same with babies. Whenever I see babies being born, it feels the same way. It feels when a baby is born, it feels just like how when someone takes their last breath.
Yeah, I mean, if you watch like a 9 months documentary or something, it's actually nuts.
Yeah, it's actually nuts.
Yeah.
So like, even though it's a joyous moment when a baby is born,
yeah.
So the feeling tone around it, I guess, is different. But to me, it still feels the same because it's not my person who's dying, so I don't have this deep grief. I'm just sort of witnessing it.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like that same feeling of like, whoa, what was that?
Now, I mean, it's interesting because in the beginning of the conversation, you were talking about like, we were talking about what's in hospice and their books. And then you were like talking about how when you first initially saw that, you're like, come on, we're like the medical community. At what point in your journey did your perspective evolve as you went along this journey, and like at what point did it evolve, if so?
I think around a year. It took me like a good year into being a hospice nurse. And what initially got me was seeing how the body really helped itself die and really took care of itself on its own, like biologically, that really made me be like, we are amazing. Like, what, however we were made, like, this is amazing that our bodies are built to die and we don't really have to do much. Yes, we do things as hospice nurses to help people with symptom management and things like that, but the body does so many miraculous things to help us die. So that was the first, like, thing that kind of clicked me into, like, our bodies really do amazing things. That right there helped me kind of turn the corner on, like, maybe there's something more. Like, maybe healthcare doesn't have to always make sense.
Yeah.
Because, like, that's not really what I learned in nursing school. You know, it was like, no, we preserve life at all cost. So to not do that and to see how well it can still work out, because I don't think death is the worst possible answer. I think, you know, suffering's far worse than death. And then once I kind of clicked into that and being like, this is really great, I really like what we're doing here, I was more open. And then, of course, then you just start seeing people's vision. And it's kind of like, you're like, oh, I mean, you can't really deny what's going on here. This is like a thing in its own. I know exactly what it looks like when someone's agitated. I know what sundowning looks like. I know what delirium looks like. It's just totally different.
Do most hospice nurses kind of arrive in a similar mindset as you, or are there people that have more resistance?
I think most of us would be on the same page with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I don't think there's much resistance. Now, I will say it's like so common. We don't really talk about that much. It's like not a thing we all like, can you believe? Because we just, it's like.
You see all the time.
Yeah, you kind of get used to it, which is pretty crazy. But yeah, it's, I would say we're all pretty much on the same page with it.
Yeah, I think that for me personally, I think my commitment is to the truth. And so when I see a pattern or when I see evidence or things that are confronting, I think for any person of any worldview, like the idea of being open-minded can be very difficult because, I mean, whether you are a Christian or a Muslim or an atheist, like your identity and your safety in some ways could be rooted in your atheism or your Christianity. Like that's like the safe space for you. And so then if you hear about an experience or phenomenon or something else that doesn't cleanly line up with that, I'm not even saying that it contradicts it, it might not, but like, but it gets to be a little, it's disorienting.
Yeah.
It's like, oh my God, like
you can feel scary.
This thing I feel so safe about and so certain about, even if it's not beneficial in some ways for other people.
Yeah.
Like I don't want to wrestle with that because it's hard.
Which would be a hard, you will wrestle with it if you're a hospice nurse, I think.
Yeah.
Because you're faced with so many things. I mean, I've seen many people who are not Christian have very beautiful deathbed visions and beautiful deaths, and Christians too. So I'm not like I'm not even anti-religion at all. Especially, I mean, I've definitely seen people who have faith in something.
Yeah.
It can be a very broad faith, but faith in general does seem to bring people comfort at the end of life. So I'm definitely not anti that. But I think if you were a hospice nurse with very, very like black and white views, it'd be hard because you're going to be like up against a lot of that. Like
a lot of the stuff.
Yeah, a lot of the stuff.
Yeah, no, I'm in the same boat as you. I mean, I think that, religion in itself doesn't necessarily have to be a negative. I mean, I think the Latin word for religion or something is like religio or something. I think it means to bind together. So the idea of like having a collective spirituality that is rooted in community can be like a very beautiful thing.
Yes.
I think it's really just like dogmatic attitudes when it comes to some of the stuff. And what I actually find to be ironic about science is science in some ways, it's not actually science, it's not the scientific method, but scientists could actually in some ways be as dogmatic as someone who is religious.
All right. Yeah. I can see that too.
Meaning that like they are so committed to the world being a particular way.
Yeah.
That actually has nothing to do with the scientific method. It's just like, that's the comfort in which the world operates this way. So I don't want to see it in any other way.
Yep.
Which is kind of exactly what someone on this other side is doing. And I think that like a lot of the stuff we're talking about today, it's just like really like it's opens up your mind a lot. And I think that could be exciting, but also just like fearful for people.
For people. Yeah. They don't want to let go of what they And I was like that a little bit. I felt like I've always been a little more open-minded, but when I first started, I definitely was a skeptic.
So what does it look like for you to cultivate a spiritual connection now?
For me personally?
Yeah.
I think it's usually quieting myself, quieting my head. My head can go a million miles a minute. So I do try to have a morning practice where I pray and meditate. So I pray, I meditate, I usually read some kind of like reflection of the day type thing. Sometimes I love Marianne Williamson. She has a good like daily reader. Mm-hmm. So I try to stay in connection with what I call my higher power. And I can tell when I am because when I'm not, the world is scary and people are annoying and irritating, and I'm very much like the fault finder, the judge. And when I am with my higher power, it's a much safer, happier, warmer place. Like the world feels for me instead of against me. And I feel like it's just a change in perception. You know, I have a change in perception when I'm with my higher power, which just shows me that like the world is for me and for you, you know, not just for me.
Yeah.
But, and it's like nothing has changed with you except for like it changed within me. And now you appear different. You know, like if I'm driving down the freeway in LA and like every car sucks, like I realize it's not the cars, it's me. You know, it's my view of the world in that moment.
Yeah.
And luckily, because I've been practicing this for so long, I feel like I can immediately like, oh yeah, what I'm doing. And kind of like, I'm not going to chastise myself for it. I'm just going to go like, yeah, there's human Julie again, you know.
Now, next year you have a book coming out, right?
Yes.
So this is, I guess, a sequel to Nothing to Fear. It's Nothing to Regret.
Yeah.
And so obviously, there's some sort of catalyst for writing that sort of book. So what's the catalyst?
The catalyst is showing people how death can really inform how we live. You know, I feel like because I've seen so many people on their deathbeds and what the common deathbed regrets are, we do get into that. But it's mostly about, you know, I feel like I've really gotten a good grip on being free in my life and like living freely. And I've gotten there because of knowing I'm going to die. There's something that has freed me because I've learned and known that I'm going to die. And I've known that because I've watched other people do it. Right. And I've seen how people who are willing to show up for their life, be honest, even if the honesty is scary and admitting that they're like afraid, how that somehow frees them to live. So the book is about that. The book is teaching people about how, like, just because you think about death and talk about death and possibly even, like, contemplate your own mortality doesn't mean that's depressing and scary. In fact, it can help you live better. And I've seen that through my own patients who've helped me. I mean, my own patients have helped me live better because of how they were living before they died and the things that they said to me before they died.
Now, there's all these conceptions, preconceived notions about what people actually regret. I mean, people have heard very stereotypical things. I mean, how does that line up with what you've seen?
Yeah, I mean, I do go into specific regrets, but generally speaking, people are not just sitting around thinking about like they don't verbally just go like I regret this, right? It's more of like in passing, you know, because I visit them week after week, so in passing I'll hear them say little things. I wish I would have this, I wish I would have that, right? The main thing that I heard all the time, which I don't hear a lot of people talk about, is people really regretting not appreciating their health and their body and like the simple things that we have because we're healthy. That's the main thing I've heard over and over again. People being like, I wish I would have appreciated how coffee tastes because now it doesn't taste the same. I wish I would have appreciated my appetite because now I don't have one. I don't crave the food I used to love. Like food was so fun before, right? So it's these things that, and I really do take that to heart. I really do. It's not fleeting for me. I really do wake up almost every morning, just this morning. And like, I feel grateful that I'm like tasting this coffee that I love, you know? And people who are dying have taught me that. Them being grateful that, or them regretting that they weren't more appreciative of the fact that they could go up and down their stairs, you know, that they could walk to the end of the block, that they could go get the mail. Like little things like that is what most people say.
What blinds people do you think to that, having that sort of mindset, having that sort of perspective, and what is like currently opening that up for you?
Yeah, I think it's because, well, one, it's like, I see it all the time. So I see people who are dying all the time. So it's a little easier for me to hang on to the fact that I too will die. And I think even just saying that, I can hear all the people listening being like, ugh, like they, no one wants to think about that they too will die. Because I think they think, or maybe it does actually scare them. You know, maybe it does actually scare them. And I think because I've seen so many people actually do it, you know, and it wasn't scary. In fact, it was quite beautiful. And the fact that we're all going to die, I feel like it's something we actually really should contemplate. And maybe if it does scare you at first, like that's okay. It's normal. This is an unknown thing. But I do think the more you contemplate it, the more you realize that that is true for you too. You too will die. The more you do that, the easier it'll be for you to solidify that, to help you appreciate, well, I'm not dead yet. Mm. You know, I'm not. I am okay today. And yeah, if I am okay today, what do I want to do with my time? And I don't mean at all like quit your job and jump out of an airplane. I just mean like the day-to-day things we forget to be grateful for.
Yeah, I could totally get on board with that. I think that in light of everything that we discussed today, I think that what you see and the deathbed visions and a lot of that stuff, maybe that does create a little bit more peace around death.
Right.
I think when there's so much uncertainty for someone in their own mind, or they're not even certain about what they believe, I think it could potentially accelerate anxiety around that subject and make you like not want to talk about it. I think there's been a lot of cultures throughout history that have had probably a better relationship to death. And I mean, even if you think about wars and like just seeing constantly being exposed to that. But I mean, we just have episode that comes out on prayer. And I think prayer is interesting. I think spiritual practices are interesting because, you know, all the downstream effects of what we just talked about with maybe bad religion and people walking away from even having any sort of spiritual language to connect with a higher power, something higher than themselves. I mean, the sense of being alone in the world accelerates if you don't have any sort of like spiritual identity. And then all of a sudden it's like, I need to maximize the world as it is. I need to grab and I need to get and I need to build and I need to like consume. I just can't imagine how much that obstructs some of the things that you're talking about.
Yes. That's, yeah. I mean, people have to want to, you have to want this a little bit. Like some people might not even want to have a higher power or to even go there or believe in that. And I don't necessarily think you have to believe in like a spirit, right? You could believe in like the greater good or that the universe, I mean, we do know that there's a universe that seems to be working itself out, right? That's something bigger than us.
Yeah.
I just know that if I were to think that way, yeah, it'd be really easy to be afraid of a lot of things.
Yeah.
You know, if you're just in it on your own. But everyone has their own journey, you know?
So what are the things that you have actively done recently that is kind of practicing this mentality?
That I'm going to die? And how can I appreciate?
Yeah, and the no regrets type mentality. Yeah.
So let's see. In writing the book, it really got me thinking. It really was like, okay, what am I doing with my life? And are there things that I am holding back? And one of the things that has come to me a lot are my parents. You know, my parents live in Pennsylvania. I'm in California. I definitely let life get in the way of of those close relationships. And I always like, if I contemplate, like if I were to get a 6-month diagnosis, like 6 months or less diagnosis tomorrow, like what would I change in my life? And the first thing I think of is I'd go be with my parents. And it's like, okay, well, if that's the case, I probably am not going to up and move and go be with my parents right now, but I do need to see them more. So recently I planned a trip with my dad. We went on a week-long trip, just him and I. And I'm going to Ireland with my mom next year. Mm. So I put in place things like that. And what mostly helps me, because if I try to like live with no regrets, you know, on my own, at least for me, that creates anxiety to me. That's like, I'm not doing it right. I'm going to regret how I'm living. So that's where for me, the higher power comes in. I'm not saying not everyone can do it without one, but with me, I have to connect to something greater than me. Otherwise, it feels like pressure and it feels anxiety provoking. But when I like connect to this thing that I think is greater and believe that like life is for me and good things are working out always, and how can I be of service today in the day that I'm in, that makes me usually have a really fulfilled day. Mm. And maybe I didn't do a bunch of cool stuff or whatever's considered cool or exciting, yeah, but it feels like I did because I connected to people. I was of service to people. I showed up for the world believing that like no one's out to get me, you know, everyone's for me and I can help people. They can help me. And that whole shift is, I think will keep me from not having regrets when I die. Living day to day like that versus trying to like do a bucket list of things. Those bucket lists are great too. You know, the trips with my parents, going to Hawaii, things I actually really want to do, but also like the day to day stuff where I try to just be of ultimate, of max service and connect to other people.
Mm. Well, my last question, so in our last conversation, we ended by talking about going home. Mm-hmm. So I kind of wanted to flip that today. So if everything you've witnessed at the deathbed has at least in part taught you something about going home, what has it taught you about how to live while we're still here?
I think it's taught me that this thing, this place that I feel homesick for, that I often cry about when I think about it, and when I see someone take their last breath, it's like that place I'm homesick for is like right there, you know, it's there. And that's why it doesn't feel so sad to me. I feel like I'm learning over time that it's always right here, like that home that I say I miss. I think that I can have it here and now, like in the present moment, when I connect to my higher power. I feel like over this past year, I've been learning that like, it's always there. Like I'm always home. I can always be home. And everyone else around me can be too. Mm. Like we're kind of all there together. We're all connected together. And I can either see the world like that or not. And when I do see the world like that, it's a really beautiful place. When I don't, it's not always a beautiful place. So I try to practice that.
Mm. Well, beautiful. Thank you for coming back a second time.
Thanks for having me. It's always great.
This is wonderful.